Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. Today's show, I sit down with Juliana Law, Managing Editor at Jing Daily, to discuss the current state of luxury brands in China, evolving fashion trends, and the impact of cultural shifts on consumer behavior. We dive into Juliana's path to China-focused journalism and go over the analysis of Ralph Lauren's growth in China and its marketing strategies. We talk about the factors behind Chanel's recent success in the Chinese market, and the current state of the luxury market in China and strategies for brand success. We get into some reflections on office fashion trends and the concept of loud quitting. We examine the Chinese brands like Florasis and Miniso succeeding internationally. We also talk about the cultural convergence in consumer values between the China and US consumer bases. We talk about trends in travel and spending among Chinese consumers, and we get into the ongoing relevance of major shopping festivals like 618. Enjoy.
When you think about luxury market growth in China right now, it's forecasted for this year about 4-6%. So what does that mean? That means there are going to be some losers in the luxury brand, you know, game. There are going to be some losers that come out. So who are these losers and who are the winners? The first kind of category would be those big iconic brands we just talked about, Chanel, Hermes, right? They really focus on the high net worth consumers, more resilient. Yet the second brand, second category, which are niche, but still serving the high net worth consumers. This is like Zegna. This is like Brunello Cucinelli, right? They're smaller brands in terms of revenue numbers. They're not making $20 billion a year, but they're serving, again, a much more resilient consumer base. And then who do you have left? Everyone else. The Gucci, Balenciaga, Burberry. A lot of the turnaround brands right now, so you know, brands that have just new creative directors are really trying to elevate themselves. So we're talking about Gucci, Ferragamo, Burberry. They're all in this kind of category, and they're struggling.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Juliana, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Honored to be here, Todd. Thank you so much for that warm welcome.
You're too kind. Okay, first, where in the world are you today where we are recording you from?
I'm in the great state of Texas. I'm in Houston, Texas, home of NASA and barbecue and Astros.
Let me ask you, what sparked your interest in China-focused journalism?
Am I interested in journalism? It's a question I ask myself every day. I'm a journalist today, tomorrow, different story.
We're getting deep early. It's
but
very
the
meta.
China interest has been there since I was a kid. And I think what really got my foot in the door was learning Chinese language. Like, gosh, it's such a beautiful, complicated, complex, like rich language. And for me, like two reasons I got into Chinese language. One, my dad is ethnically Chinese. So like my grandparents on his side were born in southern China, but then they left China during what I assume was like Mao's Cultural Revolution, moved to Vietnam. And that he was born in Vietnam, left as a refugee, like a boat refugee to America. And so each time my family migrated, the culture kind of diluted more and more till it got to me. And here I am saying like, oh, I'm half Chinese, but I have no idea what that means. Like I have no connection to the language, no connection to the culture really. And that didn't sit well with me. And so I started taking these classes to at least kind of like have some kind of relationship to China, even if it's just through language. And then the second reason was my mom always told me that China would be great for business. And sure enough, like, I mean, this podcast is proof China is big for business. So I was learning the language at the same time. So I started taking the language in high school and then in college. In college, I was also an East Asian Studies major. I focused on China. That led me to opportunities to intern in Taiwan at the Chinese Nationalist Party, which is so random. It's a political party that is currently not in power. And Then after that, I did an internship. I did a study abroad program in Shanghai. I was lucky enough to receive like a 6-month language stipend to study there. And gosh, it was the most formative experience of my life. Like going to Shanghai and actually, you know, like at that point through language learning, I'd been watching all the dramas, right? Like I've been reading the books, reading the textbooks about what China was like. And I'd been one time as a kid to Beijing, but like, you don't, you have to go in as an adult and have to really kind of immerse yourself in the culture. So when I was there, like I had a Chinese roommate, like I was setting my friends up with like Chinese guys in our dorm. Like, you know, we're like hanging out with people our age. We're lining up for Hey Tea, which was that really popular like Chinese tea brand. At the time, the lines were like an hour long. We would shop at Miniso. We were really like immersing ourselves in the culture, and I loved every minute of it. And when I went back to the US, you know, when everyone studies abroad, they like get really obnoxious about it, right? They're like, oh yeah, when I studied abroad in China, it was like this, you know, we had this and this and this. And so I was exactly the same way. I was, extremely obnoxious about it. But when I would tell my American friends about my experiences in China, they would be like, oh, China, you know, that place with the firewall, like, oh, China, you know, that place that like bans free speech, like that was their perception. That was their perception of China. And you can't really blame them because American media is not super.
That was their propaganda.
Exactly. It's exactly that. And so it like their perception of what China was and then my lived experience of it were so dramatically different. And that's not to say that China doesn't have its problems, right? But like every country does. But they were equating like political policy with all of its people, and they're just like writing off the entire country. And I didn't like that. And so I wanted to find a way to kind of like address these misperceptions and misconceptions. And so I ended up joining this small publication called Radii. Now, Radii China, I don't know if you've heard of them. They're an online publication that covers a lot about Chinese youth subculture. So at the time I was writing a lot about Chinese pop culture, like Chinese rap, like Rap of China was really big at the time. Things that people my age in China were into that I was writing about so that people would understand like, hey, China isn't this like one thing you thought you heard about in the headlines. And so that's kind of how it all started. Yeah.
Now, we got to get into your most recent article. Can you talk to us, you know, tell us about the article, what the name was. Talk to us, you know, Ralph Lauren, strong quarter, 7% sales growth in APAC. Mm-hmm. China sales up 25% for the full fiscal year. So Tell us a little bit about what the article is, kind of briefly overview on that. And then what does Ralph Lauren's success say about the current style trends in China?
Ralph Lauren is doing pretty well in China. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it fits into so many of the current online style aesthetics that Gen Z really loves. Like even on the earnings call yesterday, I was tuning in with Patrice saying that like the CEO, he was saying that quiet luxury or like the old money aesthetic essentially was one of the reasons that Chinese consumers were really resonating with the brand. And we're thinking about like the cable knit sweaters, right? We're thinking about the blazers, the button downs, things like these core pieces are doing really well in China. But it's not just the quiet luxury. There's like quite a few luxury, quite a few style aesthetics that Ralph Lauren really fits into. And that also includes like this desire for this American retro look that Chinese young consumers really like right now. When you think of American retro, think Gossip Girl, like East Coast Ivy League, that kind of prep aesthetic, like that's quite popular. As well as even more niche trends, like the Maillard trend. Maillard refers to this like chemical reaction where when you think about steak, right? And it's like brown, that's the reaction. So last fall, you had a lot of Chinese youth dressed in like all brown outfits. And Ralph Lauren has a lot of like brown colored collections, and that really fits into them. But like more importantly, what does that say about Chinese style trends today, right? I think one, you know, there's an emphasis on this like subtle, this is globally too actually, a subtle minimalist look that you kind of see style trends veer towards when the economy is down. You kind of get rid of the logos and you start to emulate the styles of the rich, and the rich kind of right now are dressing very muted. Two, you have an emphasis on the classy and the prep. And I would say three, you have an emphasis on this like vintage, like whether it's 90s, you know, Y2K or whether it's even older than that, there's quite a desire for this like older vintage look, perhaps even, you know, a sign of like a nostalgia for a better time, perhaps. And so, you know, of course, like there are a lot of style trends that happen in China that are very like dependent on the moment. So for example, like barbecue, right? Barbecue took off. Like, and it's the complete opposite of quiet luxury. It's loud, it's bold, it's fun, it's girly, huge in China. But I think what allows Ralph Lauren to be successful and, you know, all these style trends is that all these style trends that it kind of have the longevity, right? They last beyond just this one moment in time. Like quiet luxury, we've been seeing this trend for a couple years now. And I expect that, you know, when, you know, if the economy goes up and it goes back down again, it'll come back. So it definitely benefits from having a strong core offering of all these products, as well as a strong brand identity of, like, you know, when you think of American luxury, you think of Ralph Lauren. When you think of classic prep, you think of polo shirts and Ralph Lauren. It has that, the benefit of that brand image.
Yeah, that cachet. Yeah, 100%. So how is Ralph Lauren then leveraging platforms like Xiaohongshu for, you know, driving e-commerce and driving new marketing?
I would say, like, Ralph Lauren, you know, we just talked about how timeless and classic it is. It's doing a big push to really win these young consumers. And a part of that push has to be by going onto digital platforms. That includes Xiaohongshu, that includes Weibo, Douyin, and then, of course, e-commerce platforms like Tmall and JD.com. You know, when I was taking a look at Ralph Lauren's digital platforms, there's nothing that crazy that stands out. Like, every luxury brand is on these platforms. Every luxury brand is promoting. So, like, what perhaps makes Ralph Lauren stand out a little bit more? Like, I would say it really leverages key kind of calendar moments, right? And I would say it's good at leveraging local celebrities. So for example, take their Lunar New Year campaign, right? They did it on Weibo, Douyin, and WeChat. I saw the one on WeChat, and it was just like they had these exclusive, like, digital red envelope covers that were Ralph Lauren themed, and they would say, like, hey, if you guys want these envelopes, here's the time they're dropping, and once they're out, they're out. Like, they kind of build on that exclusivity and that fun, right, and that interactiveness. And then they're also releasing greetings. They kind of had this format where it looked like an advent calendar. It was like a video that played, and then this bear would click on one of the advent calendar boxes, and then this, like, celebrity or this KOL would come out, and they always choose these kind of niche fashion KOLs. So like Mr. Bags, perhaps not niche, but like niche to us, Go-Go Boy, Phil Shelby, to give their New Year's greetings. And, you know, Ralph Lauren has in the past really done well with partnering with these KOLs. So, like, last year it partnered with Mr. Bags, and that collection, so it made a handbag collection, and that collection sold out in one second, right? When you partner with the right KOLs in China, like the sales just like that, it take off. I would say in terms of digital strategies, it's not so unique, but I think one way it really does capture young consumers is this emphasis on, like, localization, emphasis on key calendar moments, as well as, I would say, gaming is a big one too. They've been really big in the gaming industry, in terms of partnerships with League of Legends, partnerships with E2, partnerships with, like, Fortnite, Roblox, all these, like, not even Gen Z, like Gen Alpha, like that kind of, they're starting to really, like, integrate themselves into the metaverse. Other luxury brands are doing this too, but perhaps not to the push that, like, the extent that Ralph Lauren is really trying to get out there.
Chanel also had a strong quarter. Can you please tell us about the factors behind their performance?
Yes. Yes, so Chanel is nearing, like, in 2023, it neared, like, 20 billion. It was, like, 19.7 billion in revenue, right? Double-digit growth across all categories, like, big success. And then when I saw it posted on LinkedIn to my kind of analyst circle, the reaction was, this is not surprising. This is not surprising. And why is it not surprising to these analysts, right? Is it seeing this pattern of, like, a bunch of different iconic luxury brands, Hermes, Zegna, you know, who are very resilient right now, even though there's, like, a so-called, like, luxury downturn, right? They're not as affected because they cater to, one, a very high net worth clientele. So they serve this very VIP clientele. Whereas, like, for example, we just talked about Ralph Lauren caring to young consumers. Well, they're not as dependent on these young aspirational consumers as other luxury brands. And so when aspirational consumers, you know, shut their purses and they're like, oh, we can't afford this, and we're not going to buy this right now, they don't really have that problem. Their consumer base is a lot more resilient. And so you see them focus on the VIPs in China, for example, through they built like VIP salons in their malls, in their stores, to emphasize on exclusivity. And this exclusivity also is you can see this in terms of their store count in China. In China, they have like 18 stores. Hermes has like 33 stores, and you see them as like the kings of exclusivity, right? But Chanel has like 18. The average brand probably has like 40 to 50 in China. So they're really, you know, making it so that they're not all over the place. They're not widespread. They're scarce, right? That's same thing for their products too. When you look at Xiaohongshu and you read comments about like Chanel flat bag, you see two things that come up. One is that this is my dream bag. That dream bag in English is the word that they will come up again and again in all these like posts about Chanel flat bags. Two would be, it was so hard to buy. And there's a sense of like, oh, it's exclusive. It's like limited. It's like, and then another thing is that it's an investment piece. So even if like maybe you're an aspirational consumer and you're not willing to splurge on like, I don't know, like a Michael Kors or whatever, you don't want to spend that money. But at least with Chanel, you go, hey, you know, if I buy it now, it's cheaper now than it will be in the future. Because Chanel, probably one of the most most aggressive brand in terms of price hikes. I think there's like another two plan for this year, they said on their earnings call, I'm not sure. But they're always increasing their prices. And so the time to buy always feels like it's now. So they're seen as investment pieces as well. So when you take all these factors together, right, it's desirable, hard to buy, scarce, you have, and then also it serves like a very high net worth consumer base, where when people who are not like that high net worth consumers see that, it's inspirational and aspirational, you know? It really, you know, cultivates the sense of like, oh, they're in a class of their own. And so when you see these big numbers come out of Chanel, it's not that surprising. In fact, there was like an RTG consulting survey they released a couple months ago. They interviewed a bunch of people in APAC. And then when they asked them, what brand do you associate with luxury the most? They said Chanel. And then they said, what brand do you desire the most? They also said Chanel. And that's not always the case that they, you know, are high, that have a higher, that there's high awareness with a high desirability to buy. So with Chanel, it's kind of high across the board.
You mentioned that there's this perception that luxury might be struggling. How would you summarize the landscape? And what can brands be doing to succeed in this environment now?
For sure. I want to preface this by saying, like, I am not a luxury business consultant or expert. I just happen to be someone who talks to a lot of people in this mm-hmm. space.
And you hear a lot.
And I hear a lot, and I track earnings a lot. I'm on that beat, unfortunately. But I got put on this beat, and so I kind of know a bit or two. And so I actually had this question come up in a conversation with another analyst. His name is Jax Rosen from Digital Luxury Group. And we had this exact conversation. It was so interesting to me. So like, when you think about luxury market growth in China right now, it's forecasted for this year about 4 to 6%. So what does that mean? It means that when you compare it to like in the past, like 2021, it was like a record high double digit growth in luxury, right? Now it's 4%. That means there are going to be some losers in the luxury brand, you know, game. There are going to be some losers that come out. So who are these losers and who are the winners? Well, based on this conversation I had with him, he was kind of classifying brands in three ways that I found so interesting. The first brand, the first kind of category would be those big iconic brands we just talked about, Chanel, Hermes, right? They really focus on the high net worth consumers, more resilient. You have the second brand, second category, which are niche, but still serving the high net worth consumers. This is like Zegna. This is like Brunello Cucinelli, right? These more, like they're smaller brands in terms of revenue numbers, right? Like they're not making $20 billion a year, but they're serving, again, a much more resilient consumer base. And then who do you have left? Everyone else. The Gucci, Balenciaga, Burberry. A lot of the turnaround brands right now, so you know, brands that have just new creative directors are really trying to elevate themselves. So we're talking about Gucci, Ferragamo, Burberry. They're all in this kind of category. And they're struggling. They're struggling because in the last few years, they've really done a lot to court the middle class consumers. And that's not wrong, by the way, because Chinese middle class have, you know, exploded in the last, I don't know, decade or so. So but now you have this problem of like, oh, if the middle class isn't really as eager to buy, well, now what, right? So now they're all trying to elevate. And the question that he posed that I really was like, wow, he said, he was like, you know, all these luxury brands are supposed to already be elevated essentially. So why is there room to elevate some more? Why is there room to elevate if you're already supposedly a elevated luxury brand, right? And so you see these brands like Gucci, like really focused in the last few years on being everywhere. So the RTG survey that I just talked about, where it surveyed consumers across APAC about brand visibility in Shanghai, the brand that comes to mind when people think of luxury is actually Gucci. But we know Gucci isn't doing very well in sales right now. So why is there this? Right? Like they have a lot of celebrity campaigns with Lu Han, with Song Wei Long, Xiao Zhen, all these big celebrities. They have like campaigns, they have pop-ups. They're really kind of courting this young consumer. So they're everywhere in terms of like social media, in terms of being in front of people's eyes, right? But when it comes to like iconic products, like in the last earnings, like leather products were down. Like, so what is the it product that Gucci is selling right now? And then it's storytelling wise, like in the past, we had Alessandra Michele, who was known for this like very eclectic, kind of over-exaggerated, bold aesthetic. You have Tom Ford with this very sexy aesthetic. And now we have this new creative director and we're not sure yet, you know, what he's going to bring. Then Core Collection seems to be doing okay in China. It's rolling out slowly in stores, right? But it's not yet a big part of their product mix. And so, you know, you're wondering like you have this high visibility brand, like how do you make it more desirable? And how does this brand now get the sales? And so I think, look, you can take lessons from the other two categories of luxury brands, right? Where even with Louis Vuitton has done a good job of like having a mix of serving the VIPs. It has the VIP salons, it has the VIP exclusive events. But it also has the cafes, it has the coffee shop collaborations, it has things that really appeal to young consumers and gets them at least aware of Louis Vuitton and makes them think, oh, Louis Vuitton is cool, Louis Vuitton is like, you know, is at the center of culture. So it does a good job of segmenting, right? And I think it also would need to really figure out like what's their it product now? Like what's their core product? We talk about Ralph Lauren, right? Ralph Lauren has all their core products, 70% of their business is core products. So I think there needs to be some kind of like product that really drives
the hero product.
Yeah. The it girl bag.
Okay. You also had a really great piece recently on office fashion trends.
Yes.
Tell us more about that and your takeaways.
To frame this conversation, you really have to understand Chinese attitudes towards the office. This is probably my favorite piece to write this year because
which has changed a lot. Since COVID,
it's
right?
It's changed a lot. And so my perception going into it, right, was like, oh, everyone's going to complain about 996. That was my thought because in the headlines, you always read about 996. And 996, for those who don't know, is working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. You know, it's illegal, but it still happens, right? Especially in the tech sectors. So when I talk to people, I'd be like, hey, you know, is 996 a thing? And they'd be like, no. Like, I don't know where you heard that from. And maybe because they don't want to like trash their company. But then when I ask them, when you rephrase the question, you go, do you work overtime? Yes, of course. Like, so where is this, you know, how is overtime, you know, playing into this? But in the past, early pandemic, you had a lot of talk around this word called lying flat, right? Which is essentially like I'm not going to do more than I have to. It's like, think of quiet quitting, you know, think of like...
That's exactly
right,
what I was going to
say. Exactly what it is, right? And then I saw this article in Financial Times about loud quitting on TikTok. Now, loud quitting is when people are like quitting their jobs on TikTok, like live. Like they're just like filming themselves to their managers quitting their jobs. And I was like... You know what? I wonder if this is a thing in China. So you go on Chinese social media and you see, hey, there's a lot of people talking about quitting their jobs. And, you know, people quitting their jobs, that in itself is not a new story. What is a new story, I think, is this attitude around quitting your jobs. It's no longer like seen as like, oh, this is, I don't have a job. That's shameful. No, I don't have a job. I'm quitting this job that I hate. I'm putting up boundaries. I'm putting my mental health first. I'm putting my wellness first. Mental health and wellness are big things right now in China. And they're seeing that as celebrations. Literally, you see last year, hot pot parties. People go to Heidi Lau or whatever. They bring this like huge red banner. Congratulations, you left your job. Like, and they're celebrating leaving their job and moving on to something different, you know, chasing happiness. When I was talking to a lot of office workers, what came up again and again was not that necessarily like the hours themselves were the reason they quit. It was really just like a lack of fulfillment, like a feeling of like, I'm stuck, like I'm not progressing anywhere. Like I'm not moving where I need to be moving. A little room for advancement is kind of what was repeated a lot. And so now you see people kind of go and take gap years, go travel and go, you know, become full-time children. That was like a trend last year. It's such a niche trend though. Like, it's going back home to your parents' house, getting them to pay you for being like a better daughter, better son. Okay. My parents did that. I live at home, okay? But, you know, you see, I was reading this survey last night from this business school in Beijing, CKGSB, and they did a survey of Gen Z workers, and they were saying how Gen Z has the lowest levels of satisfaction in the job place and the highest levels of depression and anxiety in the workplace. So combine the two, naturally people are quitting, right? So how does that translate into fashion? In the last few months, you've seen this trend come up. It's basically, in English, it's called like disgusting wear, disgusting office trends. And basically, it's people wearing pajamas to work. If you work at home already, you're naturally in pajamas. But it's them kind of wearing these like pajamas, like socks and sandals, like looking as gross as possible kind of to work. And like, and with any micro trend, I have to say, like, you know, how many people are actually doing this in real life? Hard to measure, right? But the fact that it's gone viral, I think, says something about a mindset. Like, it resonates with people, right? Like, oh, if I can't do this, like, I wish I could be able to do this, right? It's, I think, a sense of like finding an outlet to express discontent with the work conditions, or with your lack of advancement, with your lack of pay, or whatever. And so, when I was reading comments on social media, as I always do, the sentiment was like, why am I waking up so early to get dressed for a job I don't like, that doesn't pay me enough, where I don't like my boss, blah 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 blah. so you're seeing that manifest in a way of almost like a mini revolt, in a sense of like against these workplace pressures. It's a way to like let off steam, and then of course they get scolded by their boss for wearing it. So in reality, people are not dressing. Like, I asked my friend who works in Beijing in at a editorial office. I was like, what do people actually wear? It's like streetwear. It's like normal streetwear, comfort wear. But again, with these trends, I think it shows just like we're resonating with this right now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's I want to quickly comment on the hot pop parties with the banners. And I think it would be an oversimplification to say that they're partying because they quit their job. I think quitting their job isn't almost what they're celebrating. It's the courage that it takes in that culture due to all the pressures of kind of that top down, it's kind of 6-to-1 pressure that is often felt, and shucking conventional norms that say you don't love a job. You work a job for money and use the money to go do things that you love. You're not allowed to, right? And so it's celebration of the courage, you know, to say, hey, like, way to go. Like, you were able to not just quit your job, but quit a lot of societal norms that are no longer what we accept and that make us happy, and congratulations on being such an amazing, strong, courageous person.
Yeah, you put it so well. And that's why you see people who, after, you know, if it was just about quitting their job, right, people would just like stay at home, do nothing. But that's not what they're doing. They're going off, they're taking a gap year to study, they're getting a gap year to like try out new hobbies, to start maybe a side hustle, explore China, explore the world, explore themselves, really find what makes them tick. I think of it as like, if lying flat is very passive, then loud quitting is actually active. It's an active reaction to, a proactive reaction to, how can I improve my life?
I've got a few more quick hitting things. If we could do a bit of a speed round on this. The first one is Chinese brands that are succeeding abroad. Let's first talk about Floresis opening their store in Paris. Tell us about that and the broader global growth of C Beauty.
Okay, well, to put it quickly, C Beauty brands have been growing abroad probably since like 2020, for the last few years.
What is C Beauty?
Oh, Chinese beauty brands. So thinking about Floresis, Perfect Diary, there's a couple others, but those are probably the two that are the most common, that you most well known. And so they start off going to Asia So for Fluoxys, they started off in Japan, starting off of Amazon Japan and then expanding into different pop-up shops through Cosme, which is a multi-brand retailer in Japan. With Perfect Diary, they started off in Shopee in 2020. And then by 2021, they were already like the number one beauty color cosmetics brand in multiple Southeast Asian nations. Shopee is like Amazon for Southeast Asia. And so I think with the expansion to Southeast Asia, it's a little bit easier than a jump to the West, partly because there's already kind of an acceptance for Chinese brands. Like, you know, my family's from Malaysia. So when I go to Malaysia, you see already Chinese brands around. You see, you know, iQIYI, which is the Netflix of China, essentially, like, and those celebrity ambassadors, pictures of them around. There's already kind of an acceptance of Chinese culture that they don't have to like overcome. Whereas like in the West, there's still that perception that I talked about earlier, right? Where when they think of China, they think of what? Low quality goods, you know, they think of, and that's changing, but it's still there, right? Low quality, bad for your skin, whatever. So they jumped to Southeast Asia and to North Asia first. But now with Fluoxys expanding to Paris, going to La Samaritaine in Paris, which is LVMH owned. Now it's like you're seeing the C beauty brand in a sea of other premium and luxury beauty brands. You're seeing this, you know, C beauty brand in this building full of high end luxury brands. And so you're, it elevates C beauty in a way through association that hasn't been elevated before. I think it's really interesting to see. And so they plan for expansion to North America and to Europe. Of course, there's more expansion to Asia and Japan first. But with the Europe expansion, you're really seeing kind of C beauty. Hopefully, you'll see people change their perception of C beauty, and then that's Fluoxys' whole mission is to, you know, spread Chinese culture to the world. Fluoxys, if you don't know, their products are very much Chinese heritage focused. So, you know, imagine seeing product inspired by the Phoenix or the Beijing Opera or small ethnic groups in China. Like that's their products. And those are resonating in around the world too.
All right. Well, good for them. Miniso. Am I saying that right?
I think it's Miniso. I don't know.
Miniso. Okay. So you had an article or a recent piece on why American Gen Z can't get enough of Miniso.
Yes.
Tell us about that one.
You know, as an American Gen Z, I can say I can't get enough of Miniso.
What is Miniso?
Miniso is a low-cost retailer. It's like it sells a lot of household goods. It sells a lot of toys. It sells a lot of, like, you know, cups and whatever. Well, what's interesting about Miniso is that it has a heavy emphasis on IP collaborations. So, you know, you think IP collaborations, you go, Juliana, that's not new. Every business goes into collaborations, right? Miniso wants 50% of its sales to be IP collaborations by 2028. Like, it's really digging, like, driving deep on this collaboration angle. And so when I went to the American Dream store in New Jersey, which is the second largest mall in America now, you know, Miniso is opening up stores in very high foot traffic locations across the country. And I was talking to consumers there. I was like, okay, what has brought you into stores? Like, why are you shopping at Miniso today? Why are you at the opening? And they're like, you know what? It's cute. It's trendy. And it has all these great collabs. And they're, you know, relatively affordable compared to if you go to the Disney store, Disney World, like how much money you're chucking out for a Disney collab. Well, here you can get like it for half the price, right? And the quality is not that bad either. So one, it's driving, doing a lot of collaborations that are, you know, exciting. And it has a, when I say a lot, I mean a lot, like Snoopy, Minions, like Disney. And then, of course, more local collaborations too. For in Asia, you'll see like Chikawa, like anime characters, like Korean characters. So really kind of tailoring themselves to these different consumer bases. At the same time, it has a really interesting retail strategy called 7-1-1, meaning that like every 7 days, it launches 100 new products. And so, and then it puts that into circulation. So when you go to, for example, a New Jersey store for Miniso, and then if I go to the Houston store the next week, this actually happened to me. I went to the New Jersey store and then I went to the Houston store the next week. Some of the products are the same, a lot of them are different. And so it makes it for a more exciting, interesting, you know, fresh retail experience for a young consumer.
Yeah, brings it back more often and entices them to be able to go back and know that a lot of stuff is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a lot of cross-pollination between brands, lifestyle brands specifically, between China and the U.S. Take Ralph Lauren and Miniso. Is there an argument to be made that there's a lot of cultural and value convergence between young Chinese and young Americans now?
For sure. For sure. And I think there's more similarities between young Chinese consumers and young American consumers than there are differences. Like, for, you know, one thing, for example, like I just talked about is the immersive fun retail experiences, right? Gen Z can shop at their, like, they have all the devices, all the means to shop at home, you know, if they want to. So what is going to drive them into stores? You know, you have to have something that's exciting and fun. Like, for me too, like, I kind of fall into that, like, zillennial, that pocket. So I'm like, I could be the oldest Gen Z or the youngest millennial, however you want to see me. But I'm not going to go shop at a malls anymore. Maybe back when I was, like, in elementary school, that was the hot place to be, right? After school, the weekend, go to the mall. Not anymore, unless it's a mall like K11, for example, where it's like art you know, you've been to K11, I'm sure, right? Shanghai, art installations, like, it's fun. There's, like, pop-ups. There's always activities, things that drive you into the stores. People want immersive experiences. And you see that too in terms of, like, consumer sentiment when they, what are people willing to spend on? Instead of products, they're willing to spend more on travel and experiences. They also want to be, like, universally surprised and delighted. Why are blind boxes such a big selling category for Miniso? Blind boxes is, you know, you get, they're like toys in these boxes and you don't know which one you're going to get. So you open them and it's like, ooh, like, that's there's a surprise and delight element to mm-hmm. it. You will want to be surprised and delighted either through blind boxes or maybe for fluorescents. It's like you see their products are so intricately, meticulously carved. I the other day I was looking through Reddit on comments on fluorescents to see what American consumers were thinking about them. And the common sentiment was like, it's too pretty to use. Like, it's like a work of art. I feel bad using it. Like, it feels like a treat to buy. It feels like I'm fancy and being elevated and I want to feel fancy. That was the sentiment. So that's another way of feeling kind of like delighted through these really intricate packaging designs. And then of course, like we always talk about Gen Z individuality. Gen Z has a big, strong personality. But what's interesting about that is that they're much more open to trying out new brands. And that includes Chinese, you know, brands too. And so you see on TikTok, like Miniso, fluorescents are gaining traction now because people are willing to learn about them and see if they're seeing their peers try them out. They're like, hey, why don't I try that out too? Like, I, you know, they seem fun and they fit my personality, then why not? And so I think those traits make them quite similar. The one trait I would say makes them different would be the role that patriotism plays in both cultures in China, right? Especially post-pandemic, you see a big wave of what they call guochao, like the national wave, right? Which essentially is like China pride. We have pride in our heritage, pride in our country, and you see that manifest in our clothing design, see that manifest in the brands that we support, whether that's Anta or Li-Ning, which are Chinese sportswear brands. You see that in how we support fluorescents, which is like hyper-local in terms of like highlighting minority Chinese cultures, right? Not just the Han culture. Whereas in America, when you think about patriotism, you really only think like 4th of July, elections, rodeo. Like, you know, you don't have that same kind of red, white, and blue coming up in our clothing. There's a different way we view our country. And I think a lot of young Americans are actually quite critical of American policy right now. And I want to get into it. But you see patriotism plays a different way in shaping consumer preferences.
I want to talk about a couple of dates. One, the first one is the May Day in terms of travel. So it was a record-setting May Day this year. What are the latest travel and travel-related spending trends from Chinese consumers?
Okay. So there are so many things you could talk about, but I'll just hone in on two. One, yes, there's a return of outbound travel. You can find that on, you know, trip.com. We'll talk about that. But outbound travel is not expected to fully recover until 2025. So where are people traveling to this year? It's a lot of like still short haul destinations. The number one destination for May Day was Japan. And that's really not a surprise considering the yen is at, it's like what, 34 year low or something. It's the lowest it's ever been. And so on Jing Daily, we're covering constantly about Japan and why Chinese luxury shoppers are flocking there. because there's a good secondhand luxury market over there. There's a good vintage market over there. And the people are spending partly on you know, luxury goods because it's cheaper. I think I saw posts on Xiaohongshu being like the one Louis Vuitton carry-all bag is $600 cheaper than, you know, in Japan than it is in China. So why wouldn't you just go to Japan, pay whatever the, you know, cheap airline fee is, grab a Louis Vuitton bag. And then the other thing is spending on more experiences. Like, again, when you think about Chinese luxury travelers or Chinese travelers in general, what are they spending on? It's a lot more of like cuisine experiences, cultural experiences, rather than necessarily going there to Japan and shopping for all the regular retail goods. And then I would say another trend you're seeing in China during May Day is you have a focus on domestic travel as usual, but I would like to highlight that there is a trend of called reverse travel, where it's like, you know, the holidays come up and you don't want to wait in these crowded lines at the major tourist destinations, right? You're sick of that. And so you have a lot of people who are like, nah, instead of going to like whatever, the Great Wall, I'm just going to the coffee shop next door. Like, I'm going to take it easy this year. Like, I'm going to go to these niche local destinations. I'm going to go to the zoo. I'm going to be back in nature. And so you see a surge in hotel bookings on trip.com for county level destinations instead of like the big city level, like you think Beijing or Shanghai. You're seeing, you know, search for destinations like Gansu, or like a year or two ago, it was like Zibo was like a barbecue, whatever, China's barbecue capital now. Like these smaller destinations on a county level that are, you know, I think it appeals to travelers' desires for off the beaten path destinations, for unique experiences, for something that connects them to nature and has good food.
Those are kind of two of the most important things anyway. Okay, the other date, 6/18, it's coming up. It's traditionally been, obviously, a massive, massive shopping year, but things have been slowing. 12/12 was kind of canceled.
Yeah.
So I know that the sentiment or excitement around these big days is waning. It's not as exciting as maybe it has been. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing for brands, to be honest with you. Do you think consumers still care about these shopping festivals?
Yeah, I think the numbers come 6/19, the day after, will tell us whether they care or not, honestly. I think, yes, you're right in terms of like, if you look at, for example, surveys of people, how people feel around 11/11, which is the biggest festival, shopping festival of the year, right? They're already showing like much less enthusiasm than in years past to shop. So don't, like, that's not mentioning like the second biggest shopping festival of the year, right? Is it still a big calendar moment? Is it still important get like marketing moment? And should brands still participate? I mean, a lot of brands still see really good numbers from 6/18. Apple just, I think May 20th is when the Alibaba platforms launched their 6/18 activations, and Apple joined this year, cut prices by like up to 23%, and that they've made a huge amount of sales in just 1 hour alone. So it's still an important holiday for brands. I think there's like 200 luxury brands participating on Alibaba platforms this year. But the waning enthusiasm, you see that in terms of like, the numbers may be high, GMV may be high, but in terms of GMV growth compared to the last few years, it may not be as high as before. And you see these big e-commerce platforms now, you know, stay hush-hush about their numbers. And you're like, you know, if they were proud of them, they would probably announce them. And so I don't want to say whether yes or no. Well, I think we'll see when the day comes whether consumers are still truly excited. I think sales will still be good for some brands. But I think that the calendar of marketing events is so saturated that consumers no longer see this as like, I have to get in right now at this moment or I'm going to miss my chance to buy this brand. They can just wait until Singles Day, or they can wait until May 20, or they may wait until Qi Xi, or they wait until Lunar New Year. There's so many they can choose from now. And that keeping up with all of them is, frankly, exhausting.
Juliana Law, Managing Editor at Jing Daily, thank you very, very much for your time. We really, really enjoyed having you on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. For everybody on watching us on our video on our YouTube channel, please don't forget about the audio only podcast versions on all your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're listening to the audio only, don't forget to go check us out at the WPIC YouTube channel. But for me, for everybody at the negotiation team, and for Juliana Law, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.